Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For a decade, the StoryCorps Project has compiled the largest collection of any voices ever gathered in history, the voices of ordinary people talking to each other about what matters. And for most NPR listeners, this is a very familiar story. You probably have heard many of them on NPR's Morning Edition. Joining us now to reminisce and review is StoryCorps founder Dave Isay. Dave is an award-winning broadcast journalist, including six Peabody Awards and a MacArthur Genius Fellowship. He has written many books from his public radio documentary work, including three StoryCorps books, Listening is an Act of Love in 2007, Mom, A Celebration of Mothers from StoryCorps in 2010, All There Is, Love Stories from StoryCorps in 2012, and the latest, Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hi, Ann. It's always great to be on the show.
Well, you've been on for every book now, and I really appreciate it. It's always so much fun and just wonderful to talk to you about them. I want to let folks know as well that an animated feature, Listening is an Act of Love, a StoryCorps special, will premiere on PBS's award-winning series POV on Thanksgiving. So for more information, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides, and we'll have a link for you there. Once again, welcome back, Dave. The Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps, works on several levels, at least for me. First of all, it's sort of a love letter of sorts to the people who have helped you produce this magic over the past decade.
Well, thank you. And I, you know, we were on the phone before the segment started, and I, you know, it's just such a pleasure to be on the phone with someone who's read the book, and you always do. And this is such a wonderful show, which is why I'm going to come back over and over again.
Thank you.
You know, I think that, yeah, sure, it is a love letter. And I like to think that StoryCorps itself is kind of a love letter to the American people, because these stories that we hear, as you said, 50,000 now with about 100,000 people, I think. Interviews and then stories on NPR every week and these books and so forth, I think tell the real American story. And all we're doing is kind of finding and celebrating the poetry and the grace and the wisdom and beauty and the stories all around us that we can find when we take the time to listen. And it's been a privilege every day of those 10 years to do this. And I'm looking forward to many, many more years of growing StoryCorps and hopefully someday having it become part of the fabric of this country.
You know, I did read the entire book, but I didn't count how many stories there are in the book. How many did you whittle it down to, and how many did you start with this?
Well, we have a great team that works with me on the print side. And, you know, as you know, taking radio stories and transcribing them does not for a book make. You can't just transcribe the radio stories, and it just doesn't read as beautifully as it needs to read. So we put the radio stories out of our heads, and we pick, I don't know, 1,000, 2,000 stories that are of the theme of the book. And this book, as you know, Ties That Bind, is kind of our Thanksgiving book to mark the 10th anniversary. You know, StoryCorps is largely a project, especially now that it's very, very hard to get a slot. There's so much demand where people bring the person who's most important in their life to thank them and listen to them, or to honor that person by recording an interview about them. So that's what these books are about, to honor the person you feel. That's what these stories are, to honor the person that you feel most grateful to in your life. So we'll take 1,000, 2,000 stories, have them transcribed. For those that have been on the radio, put the voices out of our head and then chisel them down into the essence of the stories and again, kind of pull out the poetry in the words. I haven't counted the stories either, to be honest, but it's probably somewhere between 40 and 50 stories that just kind of explode off the page.
In all different lengths. You broke it up into three sections. The first one is We Saved Each Other. The second one is Been Through Battles. And the third one, Two Sides of the Same Heart.
Yes. Sorry, I'm actually talking to you from a hotel, and somebody just knocked at the door. Yes, so yeah, we broke it down into three sections, and basically first we find the stories, and then we look for what kind of natural sections the stories fit into. And again, you know, these books are just a pleasure to write, mm-hmm. They just kind of flow out of these stories.
My guest is Dave Isay. He's an award-winning broadcast journalist, and he's the founder of StoryCorps and the author of several books, including four about StoryCorps. The latest one is called The Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. And Listeners, if you'd like to share with us who you would, if you were to participate in StoryCorps and would honor someone in this way, someone in your life, who would it be and why? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. It, as I said earlier, it works on many levels for me, and you mentioned the element of Thanksgiving. We don't have a cut from this, and we do have other cuts that we will get to, but the story of Scott McCauley, who made something of Thanksgiving when his family wasn't there for him, it was so amazing that people like that are out there.
Yeah, you know, I think I mentioned this quote in my introduction, but I think of this this line that Mother Teresa used to say, where she used to say, "We've forgotten that we belong to each other." And, you know, this is a book that I hope helps us remember. And that's a guy who had nothing, you know, didn't have a family to go to for Thanksgiving, and every year still sets up this Thanksgiving and invites people to Thanksgiving. And I think at the end of the story, he just says, "I hope that, you know, I've made life a little better for a few people, and then I'll just kind of, you know, vanish and have had that impact on people." A lot of, you know, it's funny, I'm traveling around the country talking about this book, and this is the chance that I get to meet the people who've participated in StoryCorps. You know, all of these 50,000 interviews have been, there are StoryCorps staff there, they're called facilitators, whose job it is to, you know, to basically collect the wisdom of humanity and to bear witness to these interviews. But I'm not in on the interviews. And I get to meet the folks in the book. A couple of last week, if you remember the story of Marcela Gaviria and Dempsey Springfield, and Marcela Gaviria had bone cancer in her leg from the time she was a little girl, and she had this doctor, Dempsey Springfield, who she wanted to bring to the booth and thank. He had operated on her leg over and over and over and over again to save it, and he did save it. And she had, you know, told him as she was growing up, she'd been his patient for years. She never thought anyone would want to marry her. And this story took place a couple of weeks after she got married. And, it was the first wedding of a patient that Dr. Springfield had ever been to. And the first dance that she had was with her doctor who saved her leg. And, you know, the great thing is seeing when I meet these folks, they're exactly the same as they are in the book, but even better, which makes me know that we're doing something right in distilling these stories. And Dr. Springfield came in his bow tie, which she talks about in the book. He just came up on the stage and he said, "This isn't about me. This is about her. You know, this is all about her. I didn't do anything. I was just doing my job." And that's what we hear over and over and over again from these remarkable people who tell these simple, beautiful stories about their lives.
You wrote in your introduction that you think of StoryCorps as being in the wisdom collection business, and then referred to this conversation between William Weaver and his daughter Kimberly about his father, Ted Weaver. He recalled telling his dad that he didn't understand his algebra homework one night. Let's listen.
When I was in high school, I was taking algebra, and I was sitting at the kitchen table trying to do my homework. And I got frustrated and said, "I just can't figure this out. I'm just..." So my father said, "What's the problem?" He came by. He said, "What's the problem?" And I said, "That's just algebra." And he said, "Well, let me look at it." I said, "Dad, they didn't even have algebra in your day." And I went to sleep. And around 4 o'clock that morning, he woke me up. He said, "Come on, son, get up." He set me at the kitchen table and he taught me algebra. What he had done is sit up all night and read the algebra book. And then he explained the problems to me so I could do them and understand them. And to this day, I live my life trying to be half the man my father was, just half the man. And I would be a success if my children loved me half as much as I love my father.
And I should say that I met Lynn Weaver at an event. This was part of what we call the GRIO Project, which is one of the many, we've done about 9 national initiatives. So the GRIO Initiative, GRIO is the West African word for storyteller, and it's now the largest collection of African-American voices ever gathered. And we launched it at the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. And I was lucky enough to go down at the end of the first month of recording the GRIO stories to share these stories along with the 100 or so pairs of people who'd recorded them. And one of the people there was Lynn Weaver and his daughter Kimberly, who he had come to record the story about his dad Ted, who, as you said, worked as a janitor in Knoxville, Tennessee. And the day after that reception, I got this email from Lynn Weaver who says, "Mr. Isay, you'll never know how honored and touched I was by the playing of the remembrance of my dad. After I got home, I realized that the evening of the StoryCorps griot reception was the anniversary of my father's death. Even in death, he continues to embrace me with his love. Signed, Lynn Weaver, Chairman of Surgery, Morehouse School of Medicine, Atlanta, Georgia. So that, you know, in many ways, like all of these stories, just personifies what StoryCorps is about. Ted Weaver, the janitor from Knoxville, Tennessee, the smartest person that Lynn Weaver, who's one of the most esteemed surgeons in the country, has ever met. Ted Weaver is the kind of man we should be building statues to. And the kind of person who personifies what we should hold up to our children as who they can and should grow up to become, a person with decency and kindness and brilliance and hard work, who personifies all of those highest values of humanity. Last week we had our first gala for StoryCorps in New York, and Lynn Weaver, as usual, he actually was out of the country. He flew in from out of the country to be there at this gala to honor his father, as he's done so many times before. I mean, he is one of the busiest people you'd ever want to meet, but when it comes to talking about Ted Weaver, his dad, he will fly wherever it is to be part of a StoryCorps event.
I actually read the story in the book and then, you know, and knew he was a surgeon, and that was it. And then when I was reading your introduction, that's when it's revealed that he's as distinguished as he is.
Yeah.
So it's kind of ordinary people, but back when he was a kid struggling with algebra, he was just like the rest of us. And
that's
the
right.
Story he told, they're just ordinary people, but it does make you think that we all have at least a made-for-TV movie in us.
or better.
Or better, or much better. The stories are so touching. Let's hear from Pam in Columbus. Hi, Pam. You're on the air with Dave Isay.
Hi. Mine is about my grandmother. She was a pretty independent lady her whole life, and I was taking a women's studies class at Ohio State and couldn't get along with the teacher because I said, you know, I wanted to have kids and maybe be a housewife, and that infuriated the teacher. And we had to do a report with somebody born before 1930 about how they took care of birth control. My grandmother, who, you know, she just put it out there. She didn't, you know, hold anything back. And I asked her, and I said, Grandma, how did they do that, you know, back then? And she said, well, if they didn't want to have any children, she said she just made daddy sleep on the couch. The stories that she gave to us about our family and the history of Kentucky and how important it was to learn about our history and carry that and teach that forward just stressed everything. And I wound up becoming a teacher because of her.
She was a teacher. What a great way to honor your grandma. Mm-hmm. I hope you'll come to StoryCorps at some point. And is she still, she's not, is she alive still?
No, she passed away in 2008. The worst day of my life.
I hope you'll come and remember her. What a wonderful way to honor an important person in your life. And again, you hear that story about your grandma, and you know, you look at the newspapers, or you watch CNN or the web, and it's all dysfunction in Washington and this craziness and people shooting each other. And sure, that's a part of life, but it's a very, very, very small part of life. And it's these stories that, you know, to me, you know, kind of give me hope and give you a reason to get up in the morning and keep fighting, because these are our real, true stories, and we need to hear more of them.
Thank you, Pam, so much for that story. Absolutely. Sometimes when I get depressed from the news, Dave, I just go to the StoryCorps website and just hang out.
Oh, my God. Thank you. Well, you know, it's funny because people have asked me, you know, it's nice to be able to kind of, you know, take a couple weeks and look back on the 10 years. And a couple of people have asked me if I could sum up, you know, how StoryCorps changed me in the last 10 years, what would that be? How would you do that in a sentence? And the answer is that it's made me more hopeful.
Yeah.
And it really has, you know. We've done 50,000 stories, you know, and when I started StoryCorps, we've talked about this before. I had fears of, you know, Jerry Springer moments and people like bringing a gun to the booth. And, you know, 50,000 interviews have gone perfectly. Everyone has gone perfectly. And we've been in all 50 states, thousands of cities and hamlets, you know, Native American reservations, prisons, everywhere you can imagine. And, you know, the way that people have have come into StoryCorps from across the political spectrum and had these conversations. You know, the facilitators, when they come back, invariably, if you ask them what they've learned, they'll say to a person, we've had hundreds of them, these people who travel the country recording these interviews, they'll say that what they've learned is people are basically good. And, you know, at 1,000 or 2,000 interviews, maybe you could say it was something selective going on, but at 50,000 interviews, you have to start wondering if maybe there's real truth to what the facilitators are saying. So I'm glad that you go to the site. I do the same thing. It reminds us, you know, what's important in life and why we get up in the morning. In many ways, what StoryCorps does is it's 40 minutes in a booth with a loved one to distill that person's life and to focus on what's really important. It almost is, there's something very much about our mortality, I think, in StoryCorps. And I think of this saying in hospice where, if I can remember this correctly, the hospice caregivers will say that there are five things you want to say to someone before they die, which is, thank you, I love you, forgive me, I forgive you, and finally, goodbye. And that's a way to get closure. And in some ways, I think what's happening in StoryCorps is that we have that opportunity to get closure with people we love now and to say the things to people we love today, which is a beautiful experience and I think very important.
My guest is Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. When we return, we'll hear more cuts from StoryCorps and learn more about the new book, Ties That Bind. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour is Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps and author of several books based on StoryCorps, including the latest. It's called Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. Dave, I think for the first time, you talked more deeply about how your own personal life led you to this venture, beginning with your first radio story ever, which I think I've heard that story before, but something you learned about your dad right about the same time. Can you talk about that connection there?
Sure. When I started out in radio in 88 or 89, when I was a kid just out of college, and it was just about that same time that I found out that my dad was gay. And it was, you know, difficult. And this was 88 or 89, and I hadn't spent much or any time with gay people that I knew, except obviously my father, who had raised me, so I'd spent a lot of time with him. And I wanted to, I was not ready to kind of talk about this with him, but I wanted to kind of understand gay culture. And one day he mentioned to me the Stonewall riots, which I'd never heard of before, which everybody knows now. In 1969, it was an uprising at a bar in Greenwich Village where the patrons fought back against the cops, and it really launched the gay rights movement in this country. So I decided, as my first kind of radio documentary in 88 or in 89, I guess, or starting in 88, I went to do an oral history of the Stonewall riots and found everybody I could who had been there and interviewed them. And, you know, listening to them and getting to know them helped me understand my dad in a very profound way. And, of course, that documentary was dedicated to him, as is many ways this book, because I lost my dad about a year ago. Again, that's the use of kind of listening and exploring by asking questions and how that can build bridges and help us understand other people. I write in the book that one of the people who I interviewed became a very close friend, and her name was Sylvia Rivera. She was born Ray Rivera, and she was the person who threw the first kind of Molotov cocktail at Stonewall, and had, you know, was transgendered, obviously, and was one of the, probably the bravest person I'd ever met in my life. Just an absolutely phenomenal person. I had never, you know, I was 21 years old and never talked to a transgendered person And she just blew me away. And hearing the stories of what she went through as a kid, and just this really unbelievably heroic life she'd led, and then she devoted the rest of her life to helping other kind of street kids and transgendered kids, and you know, all this stuff. It just completely spun me around and blew me away, and changed the course of my life forever. She's and also passed away.
Is she the person that you said, why haven't you ever told this story before?
She may be. I mean, that's
and they said because
that,
nobody ever asked me.
Yeah, that's I mean, that's kind of a running theme through this book and through StoryCorps and through, you know, everything that you know, that all the work that we've done at StoryCorps and before that doing radio documentaries. You know, when you and I think we're going to play a military piece in a second. I was talking. This kind of came from a conversation I had with a great writer named Alex Kotlowitz, who wrote a book called There Are No Children Here in Chicago, and does just beautiful work. And we at StoryCorps launched a military initiative about a year ago for post-9/11 families, vets, active duty service to come to StoryCorps and leave a record of their lives. And that's going to continue for the next couple of years. And I was talking to Alex about some of the experiences with people who've served and how over and over again we hear this, you know, we have this conversation where someone will tell and you know, this just remarkable story. And then you'll say, have you ever told this before? And they'll say no. And then you ask, why not? And they'll say, no one's ever asked. Mm. And if I had a penny for every time that's happened in StoryCorps, then we would have a very, you know, healthy endowment with which to build this national institution.
Well, let's listen to a cut from that story. It's Justin Clyburn, and he's telling his wife about two boys, Ali and Ahmed, whom he had befriended while stationed in Iraq.
Once I met these children, it made every day something I looked forward to. We would play rock, paper, scissors. We would kick around a soccer ball. We were about as close as people that don't speak the same language can be. I had never been really good with children, and this was the first time I felt like I loved someone who wasn't my family member. But one day, Ali showed up, and I could tell something wasn't right. He kept saying, Ahmed, Ahmed, boom. We learned that Ahmed and his mother went to the gas station, and a suicide bomber detonated. Ahmed's mother is dead. She died instantly. And Ahmed is in a hospital somewhere.
And then he's sent home of it not long after that, and it's stayed with him all these years.
Yeah, you know, it goes into much more depth in the book. And you know, last week I got an email from Justin, which is just so typical, where he writes me and he says, you know, sir, I know you're probably too busy to answer this, but I just wanted to tell you how meaningful it was for me to be able to tell the stories of these two boys. It's changed my life. And you know, and you think and the guy thinks I don't have time to write back to him. You know, it's that just again the kind of humility and grace that is everywhere.
Like I said, you know, your work often focused not only on the ordinary, but the unseen, the ignored or forgotten, and well, I guess the ordinary. But there are some pretty amazing stories tucked in there, as we've already talked about. Rob Sanchez, he's 41 years old. He's talking to Felix Aponte, he's 28, about how the younger man made a huge sacrifice to save him. Sanchez had spent 15 years in prison for a nonviolent first-time drug offense. We hear so many stories about people like that. And he met Felix at a job placement center where he worked as a case manager. Let's listen to what he says.
So when I got hit with the kidney disease, I was sick. I had no job. I was lonely. And then Felix called me.
We were talking for a while, and you told me that you had kidney disease. I was like, but you don't got nobody that'll donate. So, you know, here I am. I'm in good health. Plus, I wanted to do something good in my life for the first time. You know, all I've done is, like, mischief and
start trouble.
Well, I don't start trouble. Trouble finds me.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
I was like, what's up? So what about me? You think I could get tested? I mean, like, I got mad tattoos, so I don't know if I could donate. So then you were like, yeah, right, whatever. All right, Felix. And then you just kept on brushing it off. And I kept on telling you.
The day that I believed it was the day that we went in for our last checkup. And we're sitting down, and Felix has a Plaxico Burris jersey on. And they're checking me, and they're checking Felix. And Felix looked up and said, look, I want to do this. That's when I knew that it was on.
That story, again, there's so much more to it about how they met and how they bonded.
Yeah. I just opened up to it in the book, and if I could read just any of it. And it, as you said, Rob Sanchez had been put in prison in New York City. They're called the Rockefeller drug laws, for a first-time drug offense, and spent many years in prison, got out, became a counselor, met this kid, Felix, who had also just gotten out. And then Robert got this kidney disease, so suddenly he was gonna die after just becoming free for the first time in his adult life in kidney. And Felix donated a kidney, and Robert ends the interview saying, now for the first time in my 41 years, I feel that my life finally belongs to me. It doesn't belong to the prison system anymore. It doesn't belong to my illness. I felt like I won the lotto because you saved my life. That was my $1 million. I'm a very lucky man. Our relationship has been more than just two friends. I hope you know that. You gave me my life back. And again, for someone like, for both Robert, whose life was saved, and for Felix, who says in the interview that, you know, he'd never done anything good in his life, and here was his opportunity with this guy who'd been his counselor to give him a kidney and save his life. It's just remarkable.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Dave Isay, founder of StoryCorps. We're talking about the new book from StoryCorps, written by Dave, based on several of the stories. Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. Anne in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome, Anne.
Good morning. What a wonderful show, and thank you so much for all of this. When I was in high school, I had to do a major test, and we had a matching to study, and one of them, the names on it was Gabriel D'Annunzio, and I knew my father had been born in Italy, but I didn't know any of his story. And he said, why don't you sit down, and proceeded for 4 hours to tell me how he had been one of Gabriel D'Annunzio's lieutenants, how he'd fought in World War I, and had been in the battalion that signed the first peace with Austria as it went down the line. And then he had joined Gabriel D'Annunzio as one of his lieutenants to go into Trieste to save Trieste for Italy. And he had a bullet in his ankle and shrapnel in his shoulder, and that bullet was removed from his ankle when he was 99. But he cemented for me a love of history, and I knew he needed to go back to Italy. And he promised me after I graduated college that we would go to Italy. So an incentive to go to college, right? In any case, I did, and I applied for a fellowship to study in Italy and won it, and took my parents with me to spend the summer before my program started, for him to get back to Italy and catch up with his roots again.
Just one question, huh?
Yes, it was just one little question. Hmm. My dad also had a gorgeous, had italic handwriting, and in addition to being an historian, I am a calligrapher, and because of him. So, in tribute to my dad.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Sounds like a phenomenal man.
The way people affect us is pretty amazing.
And you know, just listening to Anne's voice and, you know, remembering sometimes, you know, I'm sitting here, you think about the people who saved us, mm-hmm. you know, who are there for us. And that's, you know, very much what, as you know, this book is about, who are there for us when no one else was. And it just touches something so elemental in us to talk about something like that. It's just it's so kind of core to who we are, and again, I think helps us shake out the nonsense and focus on there's so much white noise around us, and it just kind of allows us to focus like a laser on what's really important.
If you absolutely, I guess, forced me to pick a favorite section. I love the whole book, but if I had to, it would have to be Two Sides of the Same Heart, which when I was writing my script, I kept writing down Two Sides of the Same Coin, Two Sides of the Same Coin, same diff, Two Sides of the Same Heart. And in this story, Denny Daniels explains how he struck up an unlikely friendship with his wife's ex-husband, Larry Rolfe, and I loved this.
I asked her what she wanted to do for Thanksgiving. She said, well, let's go over to Larry's. I said, wait a minute, you want me to go over to your ex-husband's for Thanksgiving?
I didn't really have a problem when Sharon said that she was bringing somebody, just another cup you add to the soup.
I said, well, I'll compromise. We'll go for an hour. She says, that's okay. But we kind of hit it off.
Yeah, about 10 o'clock, I thought, was this guy going to move in or what? But I am so glad that Sharon and you got married. I was a complete horse's ass with the relationship that I had. I was drinking, chasing, and Sharon was there. She took care of the kids when I was out in bars. And how she made it sometimes is just amazes me. And her last years with you, I think, were probably the happiest in her life. But a couple of weeks before she died, I got to tell her what I thought and how sorry I was, and she forgave me.
I don't know without you if I could have gotten through it. Every day you would call me, make sure that I was okay. You still do. When you lose somebody that you love, it creates a hole in your soul that's hard to fill. And you help fill that. You're more like a brother than a friend. And I appreciate that so very much.
And it all started on Thanksgiving.
Yes. I think of, I was just looking through that the section, and it begins with a remarkable story, which is, you know, I think one of the stories that has kind of most affected me over the last 10 years, and it's of a guy named O'Shea Israel, who does an interview with Mary Johnson. And when O'Shea was 16 years old, he murdered Mary Johnson's son. They were rival gang members. And about 12 years into his prison sentence, Mary Johnson went to the penitentiary to meet this man who murdered her son. And over the rest of his prison sentence, they got to know each other better, to the point where when he moved out, she had to move in next door to him so she could keep an eye on him. And now they have kind of a mother and son relationship, and they came to StoryCorps to, you know, to talk about that for the first time. And it's, again, one of these remarkable interviews of the kind of strength of the human spirit. Mm-hmm. She ends by saying, you know, I love you, son, to this young man who had murdered her own son, and talking about how she was going to get to see this O'Shea graduate from college and hopefully be there at his wedding and so forth. So, again, the strength of kind of humanity when it's kind of walking at its highest and strongest and best is can really knock you to your knees.
We have more audio cuts from StoryCorps and the ties that bind, stories of love and gratitude from the first 10 years of StoryCorps by Dave Isay, the founder of StoryCorps. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dave Isay. He is the founder of StoryCorps, and we're talking about his latest. It's the fourth book about StoryCorps stories. This one's called The Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. There's also an animated feature. I mentioned it earlier, Dave. It's called Listening is an Act of Love, a StoryCorps special. It will premiere on PBS. On the PBS's award-winning series POV on Thanksgiving. For more information, everybody can go to the website at wosu.org/allsides. But Dave, I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, we've been doing animations for a couple of years now. You can find them at our website, storycore.org. And in fact, we released one just a couple of days ago. And this is one from the book. And again, has a kind of a story to it. This is about a woman whose name is Guinevere Mann, who, if you remember, Anne, who had a brain injury and lost her short-term memory.
Yes.
Completely. And she came in with her boyfriend, Yasir, and told the story of what their life has been like with him, you know, sticking by her through this, and they tell this amazing story of running the marathon for the first time with Yasser, and she told him that every time she asked how far they've gone, to say, oh, only about 10 or 15 minutes, which he did, and she didn't remember and ended up finishing the marathon. She ran again yesterday. You know, it's interesting. I also met both of them actually at two events over the last week, and, you know, the kind of interesting uses and important uses for StoryCorps recordings that I'd never thought of. You know, Guinevere said that she's listened to the StoryCorps interview she did with Yasser 10,000 times, and Yasser told me that she listens to that 40-minute interview, you know, many times a day to help her remember, you know, who she is and what she's done in her life. So again, an unexpected but interesting use of a StoryCorps interview.
And that's animated and will be part of that special?
It will indeed, yes. But you can see that section of the animated special now. Mm-hmm. That's up, and then the rest will be broadcast on Thanksgiving and probably released the day after on the internet.
As usual, there are a lot of stories about how families are formed and the different shapes that families take and how they get there and the struggles they go through to achieve family and what a family means, including the conversation between Rami Azik and the mother of their daughter, Robin Scher. Rami and Robin Scher talk about how they decided to start an unlikely family together. Let's listen.
Ever since I was 10 or 11 years old, I knew that I needed and wanted to be a dad. I figured it would all just happen. I'd meet the girl of my dreams and I'd get married and we'd have babies. A little kink in that story was that I realized I was gay.
I was pretty far along in my 30s, and I thought, I don't have a boyfriend or a husband, and I really want to have kids.
And I would be at parties, and I would just say, oh, by the way, if you know of any women who would be interested in having a child with me, give them my number. And my friend, Scotty, said to me, I'd met this woman, and she's interested in having a child. And I called you and actually left a message saying something along the lines of, hi, Robin. I'm a friend of Scott's, and he said, you might be interested in having a baby with me, so give me a call back.
By the third or fourth time of us meeting or talking on the phone, we were pretty sure.
But one day, you seemed kind of fidgety, and you seemed a little bit tense, and you just kind of sat forward and blurted out, I've met someone, and I think I need to stop this whole process.
That's right.
And I remember feeling devastated. You were still hoping for Mr. Wright and to do this the traditional way, but a few weeks had gone by, and there was a message from you on the machine, something along the lines of, this guy is a very nice guy.
But he wasn't Mr. Wright. You were Mr. Wright.
They had a child together, and they've stayed together, not in the same house. They don't live together. They're not married, but they have a family.
That's right. That was actually just broadcast on NPR last Friday. They talk about, well, it's just, how the baby now will, how he always dreamed that he would have a kid who would run to him and throw his arms around him and yell, Daddy, you know, and he's got that now. And she's got this beautiful child as well. And they were kind of meant to be together.
You know, StoryCorps has grown by leaps and bounds in the last 10 years. What did you start with in 2003?
We started with one booth in Grand Central Terminal and a very small organization. We had four or five people and a big dream. Studs Terkel, the great oral historian, cut the ribbon on our first booth 10 years ago this month. Last month, the 23rd of October, was our actual anniversary. And he said, you know, we know who the architect of Grand Central was, but who laid these floors? Who built these walls? It's the stories of those, what he called the et ceteras, the regular people of us that you need to get. And we've like fought with body and soul since then to kind of celebrate those stories. So we're now about 110, 115 people, but I don't think we've even started, obviously, to have the impact that we hope to have someday because, you know, this it started out as kind of an odd idea. And I've been thinking that, you know, this is the decade where, you know, Twitter came to be and Facebook came to be, and here's StoryCorps, and we're still going strong. And it's about, you know, permanence and meaningful conversation and something that's really going to last in this time when so much is kind of ephemeral. And you know, someone was saying the other day that, you know, the definition of what a friend is now, you know, on through social media and all that sort of stuff, that, you know, it's unlikely that this thing would have succeeded, but we have, and we're going to keep going. And the dream is that, as I said earlier, that someday we'll be a sustaining American institution that moves the needle in this country on getting us to recognize the importance of listening and the you know, the kind of stories that we've heard, listened to today, that we find all around us when we take the time to listen, and that maybe we should spend a little less time screaming at each other and a little more time listening to each other. And if we did that, we'd be a better and stronger country. So we've got a very, very long way to go.
We hope
we're going to get there at some point.
In your lifetime, probably, people will be going to the Library of Congress and looking up so they can listen to their grandparents speak.
Yes. Well, they'll probably be able to do that on the web. Over the next couple of years, we're going to make the full archive public. You know, we are a public service for the people who participate in StoryCorps. We want to make sure that they have full informed consent about what it means to make this archive, you know, open on the web. Mm-hmm. But those people who want to have it accessible, it'll be not only accessible at the Library of Congress, but at the tip of your fingers, you'll be able to go and listen to it. And, you know, a lot of, you know, this is oftentimes an intergenerational project. We haven't done a count of the number of people who died who've recorded StoryCorps interviews, but it's certainly in the tens of thousands. So that kind of phenomena already exists, where these interviews are the only record of a loved one's voice now, and also, you know, for the great, 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 great grandchildren of the people who've recorded.
Has anyone ever turned you down for either the book or for airing their story on NPR in the morning on Friday?
Well, one of the interesting things about StoryCorps, again, we're a public service, mm-hmm. and we're here just for the. We're here to give people what we hope is a meaningful, and I think often is a meaningful experience of recording these interviews. At the end of the interview, you can sign a release that where you can if you sign the release, the interview goes to the Library of Congress, and we can put it on Morning Edition and in books. If you don't sign the release, you walk away with both copies, CDs of the interview. We erase your name from the record. You put it in a safe deposit box. You've had a good experience, and hopefully this will last for as long as you know, as it can last. And now, you know, with computers and digital technology, can last for a long, long time. And I thought we'd have a compliance rate of, you know, over 50%, but not close to 100% because of the intimate things that happens in these interviews. And I would have been surprised if it had been 80%. And 50,000 interviews later, it's 99.9% of the people who signed this release. So everybody wants to leave this record for history. No, we never get turned down. I mean, we will sometimes, everything that comes in a StoryCorps book that goes on the radio is true. And is fact-checked within an inch of its life. You know, people can, the memories are, you know, they're not perfect, and things are said in interviews every day that aren't correct, factually mm-hmm. correct. But what we edit into interviews for broadcast, for books and so forth, are correct. So there's been one case in the last 10 years, 500 weeks in a row on Morning Edition, where a story didn't check out. And we didn't air it. But that's the only, it's never been someone telling us not to air a story. It's only been a story that turned out to have a factual error in it.
Let's listen to one more cut before we run out of time and I forget about it. It's in this story, Diane tells her his name. That's her name. Diane tells his name. Tells about how she found out she was adopted. And she's talking to her daughter here.
I remember going through the family albums looking for my face in the old photographs, and I didn't see me. And eventually, when I was 37 years old, I happened to see a picture of my mom in October of 1951, and it shocked me because I was born in November of 1951, and my mother was not pregnant. So that's when I knew that I was adopted.
How did you feel?
It was very satisfying to know that I wasn't crazy. I didn't blame them. I wasn't angry with them. In 1951, you just didn't talk about those things. So when I got my original birth certificate, it said on there my birth mother's name, and it said that she was born at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. So I went to South Dakota to receive my Indian name and get a crash course in how to be an Indian. After that, my husband and I told Indian Family Services we wanted to adopt a child from my tribe, a Lakota child. And finally, they faxed us a picture of a little Indian child, and she was drinking chocolate syrup out of a Hershey's bottle. And our son said, "That's her. That's the one we need to adopt." And it was you.
Wow. Do you you still are moved by these, aren't you?
Of course. Of course, yeah. Every week, my brilliant production team brings me another story. And great every week to hear these pieces. But, you know, I think that, you know, we haven't played a lot of these in this hour, but that, you know, there are a lot of difficult pieces that come through StoryCorps. There are funny pieces, a lot of funny pieces. Mm-hmm. But we deal with, you know, we have a hospice program. We have one now dealing with pediatric hospice patients. We have a 9/11 initiative where families who lost September 11th, loved ones on September 11th come to leave a memorial on their lives. And I should say that, you know, to a person, for these folks, it's an important and meaningful experience to record the stories. But for the facilitators, it can be very difficult, and the production team listening to these stories over and over again. But I think, you know, we my team, who's so fantastic, you know, sees themselves on a mission. And again, going back to hospice, there's something that I know gets said, around tables when people who deliver hospice care are talking about patients, where they say it's not about us, you know, and that's my team's attitude also. You know, they do this work, and they know it's not about them. And as difficult as it can be sometimes to listen to these stories and edit these stories, they know that, you know, they're on a mission to get them to the world and to honor the people who have come in to record the stories. And no matter how tough it is to listen to, they're gonna kind of put that aside and do the work they need to do.
We have an email from Mayor in response to the question we put out there earlier, Dave. She says, "I would honor my three brothers who died of AIDS. They were heroes of the early AIDS epidemic, and all three of them participated in studies of drugs that eventually helped keep AIDS patients alive for a long period of time.
Wow.
Because of my brothers and others like them from the mid-90s on, AIDS could be treated as chronic disease using a drug cocktail that they tested out." She went on to talk about her brother's final days and when they passed away, and she added that these early stories of AIDS and the unsung heroes need to be told. There is a very moving story in the book about a guy whose parents end up both being gay. His mother's a lesbian, yeah. His dad's gay. He ends up mostly living with his dad and growing up with all kinds of uncles, and how what he went through when one by one.
Yeah, I think it would be great to finish with this story. And I'm in San Francisco now, and I'm going to be doing a reading tonight, and he'll be there. His name is Stefan Lynch. And if I can find it in the book, I want to just kind of read the end of that story. He talks about his in the early days of AIDS, his father and the other, as you said, his aunties who brought him up, all dying of AIDS. He lost his father and he lost everybody. And this is a tribute to them. And I hope that the woman who just wrote in will come to StoryCorps at some point to remember her brothers. It's a remarkable story. But there's one, just to read the end of
sure.
This, he says, "AIDS was horrific, but one of the things that gay men did very well and still do very well was to resist through joy. I had this amazing family, even though nobody outside my community could see it, and there was a lot of love. They modeled for me how to survive an epidemic, even if you were dying while doing it. A couple of months ago, I took my 20-month-old son, Micah, to meet my Aunt Eddie. It was really special to have this little person meet Ed, who had known me since I was just a couple of years old, and who was the only other person in the room with me and my mom when my dad died. To get to introduce Micah to Aunt Eddie, one of my only aunties who survived, was more than special. It felt like a miracle."
Yeah, that story, there are so many stories like that, stories of loss, but the miracles in that loss too.
Absolutely. And I do hope that folks will consider buying the book, not only because it's a good book, but because every penny of profits from this book goes back to StoryCorps,
right,
so we can serve more people in more places across the country. So it's kind of a double win.
Absolutely. The Ties, it's called Ties That Bind, Stories of Love and Gratitude from the First 10 Years of StoryCorps. Also want to remind folks that an animated feature, Listening is an Act of Love, a StoryCorps special, will premiere on PBS's award-winning series POV on Thanksgiving. For more information, go to our website at WOSU.org. Dave, I say, as usual, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Anne. I love doing this. Next time, we'll do funny stories.
Okay. All right. Dave, I say, award-winning broadcast journalist and founder of StoryCorps. Thanks to everyone for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. And streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support comes from Ohio State's College of Arts and Sciences, honoring internationally known composer Stephen Montague during the 2013 Contemporary Music Festival with concerts November 13th and 14th on campus. Details are online at music.osu.edu.